You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 16th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hey, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Buongiorno.
Which voices don't match?
Evan, your voice is a little deeper this evening.
Well, and I speak fluent Italian now.
With a Tennessean accent.
Very good, Steve.
That movie was awesome.
It's one of my favorites of the year. Inglorious Bastards.
Yeah, very nice.
Bastard.
And Rebecca, you got a little cold or what?
Yeah, I got a cold tonight. It's pretty cold here in England.
Now, wait a minute. There is a day in science this week.
All right, let's hear it.
All right, just... It is. Yes.
My gosh,
I've never taken so much flack from you guys for a...
Lame. Go ahead.
It was December 17th, 1919. Albert Porta, an expert seismographer and meteorologist, predicted that a conjunction of six planets on this date would spell the end of the world. The alignments of the planets would cause a magnetic current which would pierce the sun and thereby engulf the Earth in flames.
In this date on what year?
1919.
Yes. You know what that's called?
When the planets syzygy?
Syzygy. Right. I remember that. There have been a number of syzygies since then. They've all failed to destroy the Earth.
All of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what you know what you never get to see is what did the guy say after it happened?
Well, not many people know.
Milli regretti.
Any credibility he had in the field of meteorology was snubbed, gone, lost forever, and spent his days working at a newspaper.
See, back in those days, you made one stupid statement and they iced you. Today, you could just say a million things
and make a million
and make a career out of it, Sylvia Brown. Yeah, right? I mean, really, you can become a millionaire.
So Mike Lassell is sitting in for Rebecca this evening, if you haven't caught on.
Oh, yes, thanks.
So Mike, how have you been?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking, Jay.
And I understand you'll be joining us next week.
So I've been told.
Well, in 2 weeks the year-end wrap-up.
Which, right?
Yeah. Year-end wrap-up episode coming the end of the year. It's a good place for it. So Bob, have you been keeping up with that Irish company Stern that's selling us free energy machines?
Yeah, a bit. So, yeah, Stern's back in the news, and they're as wacky as ever. If you remember, they announced this company, Stern, based in Ireland, announced in 2006 that they had created a technology that produces free, clean, and constant energy. This free energy discovery has been described also as over-unity, which just essentially means that it produces more energy than it consumes, something that on its face violates the laws of thermodynamics. Some claim, though, that this does not violate these laws, since they are not claiming to produce energy from nothing strictly. It's just that the energy is coming supposedly from an as-of-yet unidentified source. So, okay, I feel much better now. Just a brief history here. They plan to demonstrate their Orbo engine to the world in London in mid-2007. You might remember that from a couple of years ago, only to fail epically as they couldn't even get the thing to work in the demo area. Something about the demo area.
The lights, right?
I heard it was a bearing or a ball bearing or something.
First they said the lights, then I heard bearings, and then I heard that they're really not sure what happened, but whatever, it didn't work, and which is kind of bizarre. Because, you know, one assumption you got to make or one thing I'm sure a lot of people would think is that, well, either they're deluding themselves or they're charlatans. And if they were charlatans, you would think that they could at least get this stupid thing working. But, you know, there's a million different ways to make something like that work other than using free energy. So the fact that something simple like this didn't work kind of made me think that, okay, maybe they're just massively deluded and it's not realizing that there's some external source of energy going on here. The next bit of news came earlier this year. They used a jury, they called it a jury, of 22 independent scientists and engineers to evaluate their claims. And this took over a two-year period. So after that time, they unanimously agreed that Stern's demonstrations did not show the production of energy. Stern, of course, came out with some lame excuse, saying that the energy that these jurors were evaluating the data was from up until 2008, but the 2009 data, well, that was the good stuff. Well, yeah, of course. And if that's the case, and what convinced them prior to 2009 that there was even anything there? Now, the latest farce in this fiasco is yet another hyped demonstration for the world. this time's in Dublin, Ireland. They actually got the thing running this time, so woohoo! But it's so underwhelming. I was just yawning, just reading about the damn thing. I read it. Some guy posted a blog describing what was going on over there. He was actually there on site. And he said it seems to be just like an electric motor / flywheel arrangement spinning using magnets. They also use a battery. And the new bit here, one of the new bits here, is a generator that they attached that will actually recharge the battery as it goes on. And that's pretty much it. You know, watching this thing spin for hours or even days, it doesn't really prove anything. And that's pretty much how these free energy devices work. You know, when they do have a demonstration and it actually works, all you're pretty much doing is watching this thing move. And that doesn't mean anything at all. Even if you watch this thing spin for a week, so what? It just really, that doesn't prove anything.
Yeah, right. So it's a motor run by a battery, and then they just recoup as much of that energy as they can by using the motor to run a generator to recharge the battery.
Right.
Right. So they're just closing the loop. So it'll slowly wind down based upon whatever its efficiency rating is, you know, whatever loss of energy there is.
And it could be very efficient, and it might take actually a surprising amount of time to actually wind down there. But so what? I mean, they don't even have a meter on this thing. How easy would it have been to include that? So the bottom line, you know, if this is the best that they can do after years and millions of euros, if I had these resources – and I had the discovery of the millennium, which is what this would be, I'd like to think that I'd be able to produce a working, practical machine with unambiguous inputs and output measurements so that you could see exactly what's going on. I mean, that would be a bare minimum after all this time and money, and they don't even have that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you mentioned, Bob, that, you know, we never know with cases like this how much are they just incompetent engineers and scientists, or is this all a scam? You know, you never really know, but this pushes me towards the scam.
Scam.
Because what are they spending their money on?
It does.
Right? They're just you have to wonder.
Oh, those limos out front aren't free.
And
you know,
the other thing is they put up this very slick video. They probably spent more money on this video than on Orbo technology itself.
Yeah,
in which they are sort of mocking the people who have been mocking them.
I was confused for a minute. I was like, wait, is this a skeptical treatment? What's going on
here? No, so it's like saying, it's quoting its critics saying it's powered by, you know, it's fairy powered, right? But then, so they show the machine running as if the critics or the skeptics who are saying it's a fraud or it's Blarney powered or fairy powered are must be full of it because here it is working, you know? So they're trying to turn that to their advantage, which is slick. It's a little bit too slick, you know.
Yeah,
it's the kind of slickness that a con artist would come up with. Also, here's the CEO of the company is standing there saying how they discovered this new effect, this new property that enables them to create energy out of nothing, and it's freaking magnets.
Right, it's a magnetic anomaly that has escaped scientists.
Not only that, but the spinning magnet thing is like a century old. People have been fiddling with magnets for a century, trying to figure out how to get energy, make an over-unity machine with spinning magnets. It's been picked over and picked over. It's the classic fraudulent free energy machine. It doesn't get any simpler than that. And then you look at their machine, and it's just freaking spinning magnets. Come on, that's it? Really? That's their physics-breaking breakthrough was something that anybody can whip up in their garage. It was totally underwhelming.
And a couple little bizarre things. Well, one thing was I read some comment. Some guy who seems to know a bit about machining and similar things was saying that there was he saw like a subtle wobble to the to the spinning disc, and he's like, this isn't even made well. You know, it's not even made as well as you might expect with all this money and time that they've had. And another guy, this one was interesting. Now, they made this – the whole thing is apparently made out of some transparent type of plastic or polycarbon, some kind of see-through material. So you can kind of see through pretty much the whole thing. Kind of, you know, it's kind of transparent, except the bottom of it, though. He said the guy on site was saying that the bottom of this thing is not clear like everything else. And of course, that kind of makes you think, well, what's going on down there if they don't want you to see what's going on down below? I mean, is this some other little power source that they're trying to hide?
That's where they got the squirrels in the cages running around?
You can't help but think that. And maybe there's some reason why they needed to have an opaque section to it, you know, and it might make perfect sense. But you can't help but think that, considering all this other nonsense going on.
Yeah, it's like the bottom of a magician's box, you know, when he's sawing a lady in half or something.
So are they getting money out of this somehow?
They're getting investment money.
Yeah.
But also, Engadget made a good point. They pointed out that recently, Storn Labs, you know, this company, was selling a device they called the USB Hall Probe, which is a magnetometer. And Engadget said, basically, for $400, you could turn your $1,000 PC into a $40 magnetometer.
Right. Or a $400 magnetometer.
That sounds like a good deal.
Yeah, that's quite the device you got there. So they were speculating that maybe, you know, Stern is using this to hype their brand so that they could sell other crappy merchandise.
Oh, yeah, a form of legitimacy. You know, there is this legitimate, perhaps, part of it, and that lends credibility.
The USB Hall Probe seems like a crappy device, too. But
talking about their image, right. Yeah, but I'm just talking about how they're portraying themselves.
It all sounds like a marketing strategy. That's,
yep.
That's the point.
Brand enhancement ploy.
Yeah.
We're not pointing fingers, but my fingers pointed at them.
But it's a little suspicious.
Mm.
Next news item is about communicating with people who are locked in. Now, recently we discussed the case of about the man in Belgium who was in a coma for 23 years, and it was discovered recently that, in fact, he was not in a coma, but he was locked in. But then a facilitated communicator got a hold of him and has been using facilitated communication, which is a totally bogus method, to talk through this guy, right, or to have him talk through her. And essentially she holds his hand and moves it across the letters on a computer screen. And she's obviously the one doing the communicating. It's almost impossible for that guy to be guiding her. That has been in the news. So I was intrigued recently that there was an updated news item on some legitimate scientific methods for communicating with patients who are either locked in or otherwise paralyzed and unable to communicate using machine-brain interfaces. Now, we've talked about this kind of technology previously, and this is an interesting update. Essentially, this is the technology where you have a computer interfacing directly with a brain and using that in order to run some software program, whether it's connected to a robot or a cursor on a screen or a light switch or whatever. It's just a way of controlling machinery or communicating without being able to move. Now, currently, in people who are locked in, who are unable to communicate because they're physically paralyzed, if they could blink or even move a little finger or something, there are methods to communicate with them, you know, through that minimal movement. Or if they can move their eyes, they can look at letters on a computer screen and, you know, a specialized computer device where it can read where they're looking and they can select letters just by looking at them on a screen. That kind of thing is currently the state of the art. But what mind-brain interface technology does is directly read the electrical activity of someone's brain and translate that into a computer signal. So far, most of the research has involved either using a surface electrodes, like a helmet, on people or implanting electrodes in monkeys. This is the first study I've seen now where they implanted electrodes in a person, in a human being. What they were able to do was they put the electrodes over the motor language cortex, so the part of the brain that controls the mouth for speech. The subject was able to learn to create three vowel sounds using a voice synthesizer. So here, it doesn't really matter what the output is, right? You could easily have connected this to software to print letters on a screen or to move a machine or whatever, but they connected it to a synthesizer. The only thing that really matters is how many different states can the computer software discriminate? And in this case, they were able to discriminate three states, which they then translate into three vowel sounds. Interestingly, because they could play them back to the person, that created a feedback loop so that they could train themselves, you know, to get the computer to say the sounds that they were trying to make. The hope is, of course, that if they can get this, you know, an order of magnitude or so more sophisticated, then they may be able to allow someone somewhat natural speech, you know, through a computer or voice synthesizer just by thinking the words they want to say. That of course would be a significant improvement in communication for people who are paralyzed and can't speak.
So have they achieved this with anyone yet?
Just the three letters, just the three vowel sounds. That's where they are. So it's really not that much better than any other research program on mind-brain interface. You know, a lot of the other ones also can distinguish around three to four different states. And again, you know, what you choose to do with that information, it doesn't really matter. The technology's in reading the brain waves to discriminate different states. And that's determined by where you place the electrodes, how many electrodes, and the software that's used to interpret them and the training program to get the person and the computer to work together. You know, just like if you ever used voice recognition software, it's a similar kind of thing where there's a training phase to it. Interesting technology. This is one more sort of baby step in this whole brain-mind interface thing. Because I always love it. The researchers say, "Yep, within 5 years we're going to have, you know, significant improvements where we'll be able to use this." They always seem to say that because they're basically saying, "Yep, in the next funding cycle, we're going to make we're going to achieve the clinical outcomes that are significant." It's almost tongue in cheek now when they say that magical 5 years is always what it takes to make significant improvements. I don't know. I'm not holding my breath. I think this could easily be 10 or 20 or more years, you know, before their thoughts are being translated into understandable speech. But eventually it will come. I guess the question is, what's the ultimate sensitivity of EEG signals in terms of discriminating different brain states?
Are the electrodes directly on the person's brain, or
in this case? So there are companies that are looking, and research programs looking at brain surface electrodes, and others that have implanted electrodes into monkeys, like that. Remember the monkey that could feed itself with a robotic arm?
Monkeys.
That was pretty impressive, actually. But so this one, there's just a series of a few electrodes, and interestingly, they use radio signals to communicate to outside the skull. So there's no wires going through the skull or the skin, which is good because that's a setup for infection. And you can just recharge the batteries with an external coil, so it's completely implantable. But that technology's already exists. That was no breakthrough in and of itself. But it's always fun also just to extrapolate into the future. You know, how detailed are we going to be able to get in terms of reading brain activity and then communicating directly to a computer?
5 years.
5 years. Right.
You know, eventually, though, of course, we're going to have incredibly tricked out brain-computer interfaces that are going to allow people to do a number of things. You know, I mean, this is just a fledgling version of what we're going to have.
Yeah, it's in its infancy. You know, I mean, this is the Matrix technology, right? This is it. It's the same thing. It's just a matter of what are its ultimate potential and how fast it's going to take to get there.
Could it go the other way around? Like, could you teach someone something like that through the electrodes? Like, send signals to their brain? Or is that just too far off?
That is probably orders of magnitude more difficult than the other way around.
Oh,
yes,
no,
right. I imagine that's going to be a lot more difficult because the level of precision of inducing the right, you know, neural activity in order to create the memories that you want, the information that you want. First of all, I imagine it would have to be calibrated to each specific person's brain, and that calibration would be intense. It would probably be a while, if ever, before it gets to the point that it's more efficient than just, you know, the good old-fashioned seeing or hearing. You know, those are actually pretty efficient information transfer methods.
Yeah, but Steve, if we were to imagine the thing that we saw in The Matrix where, you know, they had a computer basically pump that information into the guy's head, I mean, they're creating, like you said, memories and information, and they're creating neural pathways that flat out just didn't exist, right?
Yeah.
You know, as a neurologist, just take a stab at this. You know, like, I know that.
Well, gently, put down the scalpel.
You couldn't do that with like electricity, right? I mean, like, how would you stimulate something like that?
Yeah, I
mean,
I think just electricity, I don't think would do it. I mean, you really need to induce neurons to fire themselves.
So it's like groups of neurons firing at the same time, and then that coordination would create connections in places that didn't exist before, and you know, it's,
yeah, but you would have to be interfacing with neurons, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Would it have to create extra neurons or just just the connections?
Well, learning involves both of those things. You know, it involves changing the pattern of connections between existing neurons, the strength of connections. But also with, you know, plasticity means you're actually growing new neuronal pathways. So both of those things are involved in learning.
And I wonder how, let's say that you had a device that could do that. I wonder if it could be as fast as they showed it in the movie. Like, you know, could it be 15 seconds and then you've learned something that would, you know, traditionally take 1,000 hours?
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is the brain's not a computer. You know, you would need some kind of nanotechnology that was literally interfacing with broad regions of the brain, not just a jack in the back of your neck. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You would need machines to take over the world and then figure out the technology to implant.
It's hard to extrapolate even from existing technology to figure out how you would do that.
Connect your brain to a series of computers that help you.
We'll see it in 5 years.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. It's probably more likely that we'll have a computer that we implant, either we wear as a cap or implant in the skull or something. Just, you know, some ectopic computer.
You change the data in the computer, and then it has an interface with your brain.
Well, then, yeah, the computer interfaces with your brain. But you don't. It doesn't have to, like, new information doesn't have to be stored in your brain. It's just stored in the computer. But that computer becomes an extension of your brain because you interface with it sufficiently to do that. That would be a lot easier, I would imagine, and also a way of not just having, like, this fast learning, but also extending the capacity of your brain, right?
So you can actually go to people and say, "Hi, I'm a PC," or "I'm a Mac." If you're a hippie,
right. Yeah. But Steve, it's not just the adding something like more memory or data storage. Like, you know, for example, if I go out and I learn how to snowboard, you know, I'm coordinating all different parts of my brain.
Yeah.
All sorts of different things at the same time. It's not just like, here's an encyclopedia of data.
That's true. And there are certain functions might translate easier to this than others. And I imagine that, you know, learning how to do complicated motor functions, because that does involve multiple motor subsystems distributed throughout the brain, probably
it takes up more of your brain, doesn't it, Steve? I mean, people like to think that higher thought and emotion, you know, the brain is devoting so much energy to it, but actually the motor skills take up a huge portion of the brain.
There's the motor cortex, there's the premotor cortex, there's the cerebellum, and there's also the extrapyramidal system, all working together to produce fluid, coordinated, learned movements. So yeah, it's a lot of tissue that's involved, which may be more than just, say, doing mathematical calculations, which is just in one small part of your dominant side of your parietal lobe. Even though you might think of, like, doing mathematical calculations as more sophisticated, doesn't take more brain tissue. So, but Jay, imagine if you had a computer that was essentially like a third hemisphere of your brain, and not that it was enhancing everything all your other, you know, two biological hemispheres do. It just was a repository of not only information, but other kinds of processing, like maybe another calculator, just to use a simple example, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it interfaced sufficiently with your brain that your brain could actually learn how to access information from this computer, right? So it actually be, especially if it was implanted when you were young, and then your brain developed.
Would adapt to it.
And adapted to it, because, yeah, you basically exploit plasticity.
Hmm. Yeah.
So that your brain grows in order to interface with and utilize this computer, so it really becomes like a third hemisphere. And then it would be a significant extension to your brain capacity, as well as a computer, so that you could just download new information to that part of now your three-hemisphere brain, if you will.
Steve, yeah. I don't think that would be very popular, though, because think about it. First off, just to do those experiments would take way too much time. It would take a lot of time. First, it would take generations of monkeys and pigs and whatever other animals they decide to test that on. And then to actually find that first kid, the first parent who says that you could use their kid to test something like that. I don't think anything like that would ever really be popular or take off. I think people will want to try to figure out how to do it in adults, whatever it takes. Maybe it'll be harder because the brain is less plastic, but I think that would be much more popular than experimenting like that on kids.
I think you're speculating too much, Bob. I don't think we can say seriously. You're there's so many assumptions in that speculation, and we're thinking so far in the future that we can't even start thinking about stuff like that. First of all, I mean, you may be right in that we will focus on doing this in adults, but perhaps by then we'll have the technology to really jack up the plasticity of an adult brain and make it like a child's brain. Uh-huh. So it won't matter as much.
Well, then what about the time factor?
There are some things just take a lot of time to evaluate scientifically. You know, any time when you're looking at the 10, 20, 30-year health effects of something, it takes that much time to figure out what those effects are. But we do the best we can, and it'll get studied. The possible advantages of this are so huge that I think some segments of the population will be accepting of it and will take advantage of it, and then that might even create pressure for other people to do it, right? You know, you're going to have your kid in school sitting next to another kid who has a neural enhancement and who's vastly smarter than him. You think about it that way. We talk about like the digital divide. Imagine the neural divide that might exist right in the future, where you have people who can afford to have a computer interface literally being on a different plane from people who don't have it. I mean, the abilities that they would have could theoretically be enormous. So it's going to create a lot of complications, and I just don't think that we could think that far in the future. And
we're not even talking about other neuro enhancements using genetic tweaking, using, say, viral vectors to tweak your genes, or pharmaceuticals. There's so many different ways to approach this. That you're right. It's so complicated. It's hard to extrapolate beyond a short period of time. But can't wait to see what happens.
Right around the corner.
Human experimentation, I don't think, won't be much of a problem. Just tell Jay that he can hook up his porn drive directly to his brain.
That's right.
Wow, could you? Oh, my God.
That's the day we lose Jay.
Science fiction writers have certainly speculated about what would happen when we have the ability to jack into our pleasure centers. When you could push a button and get an effect that's better than any drug in existence today.
Man will exert self-control and
limit
themselves.
It's almost scary.
Yeah, right.
The potential there for you can almost make people slaves just by, slaves to that button.
Yeah, but don't forget, though, I've read a little bit about this. Don't forget that people have the knee-jerk reaction to that statement, Steve, of being like, blissed out on the couch and that's all you want to do is just hang out. I mean, you could conceivably do that in a way that you still will, you will be blissed out in a sense, but you will still be motivated to want to do things and achieve things and not just kind of hang out.
Again, we don't know if that's even possible, but it is easy to extrapolate. You think about, someone who's a heroin addict and the kind of life that they lead when they're totally, enslaved to heroin, and just think, well, what about something that's 10 times more addictive? What kind of effect would that have? You're saying that there would have to be built-in factors in terms of how it works that would lock people out or prevent those kind of effects from occurring. But I'm just saying, a black market of
the ultimate addictive
neural interface. Imagine not just raw pleasure, but also a feeling of happiness, of oneness with the universe, a sense that everything is good and everything is nice.
Yeah, screw that feeling.
Like every good feeling you can possibly have all rolled into one. That's the kind of thing that we could theoretically create with neural interfaces. It's just hard to imagine that there's not going to be abuse of that in the future.
Oh, we're in danger of going a little long with this.
A little bit. Evan, tell us about ancient ruins of the Caribbean.
Oh, I would love to, because there is an exclusive report in the Herald de Paris, which is French for the Herald of Paris. Headline reads, previously undiscovered ancient city found on Caribbean seafloor. I love how the headline, that's it. If they found it, previously undiscovered, ancient city on the seafloor, right?
Yes.
That's it. So therefore, the body of this article is going to have the science and data to back that up. Is that right?
We'd hope.
Based on the headline. Exclusive. Researchers have revealed the first images from the Caribbean seafloor of what they believe are the archaeological remains of an ancient civilization. Guarding the location's coordinates carefully, the project's leader, who wishes to remain anonymous at this time, says the city could be thousands of years old, possibly even predating the ancient pyramids at Giza.
So we have an anonymous scientist at an undisclosed location.
Now that is hard science.
That's transparency, baby. All right, so he could say, yes, we want to be the first ones to... We don't want anyone to scoop us. Fine. So we'll reserve our judgment until you actually show us some, you know, archaeology. The one thing they say that's reasonable in this article is, until we get down there, we can't really be sure what we're seeing on these satellite images.
That's like their escape hatch for later, Steve.
Yeah, but that's true. I mean, that's the standard archaeological position. You might scope out potentially lucrative locations by plane or satellite, but you don't really know what it is until you get on the ground and see what it is. So that much is reasonable, but the thing is, when you look at these pictures, it looks like digital artifact.
Right.
Big time.
Either that or it's a vast city. I mean, it looks like you're looking down at New York City, you know, from above with the squared grid pattern and buildings
kinda.
And whatnot.
Someone likened it to a close-up if you were a little tiny creature on a computer chip. You see all the lines and right angles and so forth. There's the circuits and transistors and stuff.
But when you zoom in on these pictures, it just looks like digital smudge, digital snow, yeah.
Now, I'd like to invoke my time machine, if I may, bust out the time machine and bring us back to February of 2009.
Is it DeLorean?
Oh, of course.
February of 2009.
In which article reads, Lost City of Atlantis found on Google Earth?
Yeah, right.
Not quite.
that was a mapping artifact.
Lines, right? Yes. Yeah. So more shots from satellites from above and so forth. And those lines were actually sonar artifacts from a boat that was gathering data for Google's...
Show us some actual artifacts and we'll take you seriously.
Right. But I mean, come on. What about this headline? Previously undiscovered ancient city found.
Right. There you go.
That's responsible.
My goodness. And, you know, in the Caribbean, really? I mean, that's not exactly the deep sea. And it's also, he said, this is in a shallow part of the Caribbean because otherwise the satellite wouldn't have been able to see anything. So some shallow part of the Caribbean, there's this previously undiscovered vast ancient city starting to... You know, sound a little implausible there.
No. Yeah. However, the unnamed project leader did deny that he had found Atlantis and says the romanticized ideal of Atlantis probably never existed.
Yeah.
The whole idea of this is absurd because, okay, so they found this. Now dive down and see the foundations that we're supposedly looking at, like, or whatever they are, streets or whatever it is those lines represent. Send people down there and figure it out.
Yes.
Right? Like, where's that? Where's the money going into that?
Well, they say they're going to do that. So that's the point, though, is why even talk to the media until you've got some artifacts, right? Why take the chance of being scooped and why say, yes, here's some smudgy, worthless photos from an undisclosed location from an anonymous source? Why even bother doing that?
Well, because if it ends up being something, then people remember them. If it doesn't end up being anything, then just everybody will forget about it. So it's a win-win.
Yeah, but they're anonymous. So who are we supposed to remember? You might think that they're again trolling for investors, and maybe they are doing that. Maybe they're using this to back up private connections they're making, looking for investors, and say, see, as reported in the Herald de Paris, you know, we just need somebody to fund our expedition, and then we'll find, you know, this ancient city. That could be what's going on. But normally speaking, scientists don't call the press release until they got the goods in hand, you know?
Oh, those French people.
The project team asked that for more information or to find out how to help fund their research, please contact blah, blah, blah at yada, yada, yada.
Mike, I hear you have a lovely bunch of coconuts.
Yes.
Beg your pardon, doctor.
I've got a lovely bunch of coconuts, fiddly-dee-dee.
Okay.
Wow.
I knew it.
Bravo.
I heard there's octopuses somewhere out there that are using coconut shells as portable shelters.
But did you all see the video? Because
there's a video?
Fantastic.
Oh, yes. Cool. Yes. Really? I didn't see the video.
All right, so it is fantastic. I mean, this octopus, imagine a half of a coconut shell, a rather large one or larger than I thought it would look. And it also looked like it had been underwater for quite a while by the buildup that was on it. But the octopus comes out of the shell, and the round part is on the bottom, and it picks up the coconut shell with its legs and walks away. So the coconut shell is kind of like where its butt would be if an octopus had a butt, and the legs are draped down over it, and then it scuttles away with the shell. Just looking at the way that its tentacles move, the coordination is phenomenal.
Yeah, and they show another one actually closing itself up in two halves of coconut shells.
Yeah.
And then it walks away, clomping them together.
The main researcher said the first time that she saw it take place, she almost drowned because she was laughing so hard because it was just totally unexpected.
Yeah.
I had no idea that the octopus was going to do
now,
that.
Here's the one part of this story that I'm a little dubious about. They're calling this the first instance of invertebrate tool use. But is this really tool use? Because, you know, octopi will – they like to hide in things, right? I mean, that's part of their behavior already. And sometimes they will – if there's an empty, you know, large enough shell, they'll, you know, hide inside the shell. So, yeah. Okay, this is a coconut. It's really just an extension of their existing behavior to something they're, you know, finding on the ocean floor. I don't know. I would really qualify this as tool use, though. I think that's
a
stretch.
Yeah.
The novelty here is that they're carrying it around, right?
Yeah, but so what? What if it were a shell? Would that be tool use?
Yeah. Aren't there already some crabs that use shells?
Yeah. There's a shelter. Yeah. I've seen a crab use the top of a bottle as its shell.
It's just a home. It's just this or a hiding place. It's... I don't know that I buy the whole tool bit.
But Steve, no doubt, though, it is it's behavior that we're not used to seeing.
I don't know why they find this so darn surprising, because behaviors are not narrow. Animal behaviors are always more varied and adaptable than you might at first assume, right?
Mm-hmm.
These coconuts, because they've been discarded or whatever, are now part of the environment, and you know this is not that much of a stretch for an octopus to climb inside, you know, a coconut shell. It's cool, and it's fun to watch them do it, but I don't think this is out of the range of existing octopus behavior.
Yeah. It's not like it's grabbing a stick or something and digging in the dirt to get something to eat, right?
Right.
That would be fascinating.
It is a shade of gray, right?
Yeah.
So it is a behavior that I was surprised to see, not that I study octopi. Is that correct?
Yes.
You study sharks, right?
Octopodes.
It's got suction cups on its tentacles.
Yes, that's correct. You are correct.
Steve, it has two eyes.
Steve, you're an octopi. You're an octopode tool denier.
Stop denying the octopus.
Yeah, Steve,
I dare you to
you're awfully
that.
Negative tonight. First Bob, now the octopus.
Yeah. I'm cranky.
You think this octopus is related to the tree octopus?
The tree octopus? They're endangered, you know.
Yeah.
Steve,
yeah.
With this quote.
Yeah, the coconuts with, and the trees.
With this quote match the way you're feeling?
I'm feeling mighty low.
Oh my God.
Nice.
I love it.
I can't.
I'm not feeling as low as Billy Joel's daughter, though, Alexa Ray.
Oh, the poor girl.
Who apparently tried to commit suicide with a homeopathic remedy.
Here, I'll cover this real quick.
She tried drowning herself.
She's 23 years old. She had broken up with a boyfriend a couple of years ago and, you know, had a rough couple of years. And, you know, it is a rough time. That's a rough age to be at. It does suffer from depression.
She said she took 8 pills, and these pills were called Tramiel, and they're classified as a homeopathic remedy. I looked up the pill, if she took these pills.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she claimed that she had trouble breathing, and having a hard time breathing, a lot of things can cause that. One of them is anxiety. But anyway, this pill isn't what I expected it to be. It has a lot of different things in it. It has belladonna, chamomile. It has
But you're right. But I was trying to figure this out too, because it lists, like, under belladonna, it says belladonna 4x 75 milligrams. Does that mean they start with 75 milligrams and then dilute it 1 to 10 four times, which would give you not much at all, or is after the 4X that you result in 75 milligrams?
I you know, Steve, I had the same exact question.
I think the former is
yeah, you start
guess.
With 75 milligrams, then you dilute it 1 to 10 four times, which is a 1 to 10,000 dilution, yeah.
Which
so you end up with a very tiny amount.
Yeah, so the question that we're trying to answer here is, did she actually take nothing pills? Like, were these just, you know,
did she get an active
pills?
Ingredient, right?
Or was there an effect in this pill? Because there's another side to this, Steve, that I was thinking about, was mm-hmm. that, you know, these are some legitimate chemicals here.
Yeah.
There's some legitimate chemicals that were present, and if she took eight pills, you know, I don't, you know, nobody knows to what level each one of these compounds were at, but something in there could have had an effect.
Yeah.
I mean, I read up on at least half of these, and they all did have some proven effect.
Not all of the ingredients have a quote-unquote proven effect, but I wouldn't say that. That can be misleading. They're herbal drugs. Yeah. So, yeah. And they're diluted, and some of them are only 2x, you know, which is like a 1 to 100 dilution. That's not that much. So there could actually be an active amount of some of these ingredients. So they're in small amounts. So that's the ambiguous definition of homeopathy. How much does something have to be diluted before it's homeopathic? Some quote unquote homeopathic products have actual measurable amounts of stuff in them. And they are more like herbal products than homeopathic. And this one's on the edge because there's lots of herbal stuff in there, and the dilutions are not that great. But it's still, I think, overall the total dosages would be tiny, to the point that eight of them probably wouldn't propose any health risk. But anyway, and also, I do want to point out we're not trying to make light of the situation itself, of somebody who is making a suicide gesture or attempt, whatever it was.
No, it's just ironic.
It's just pointing out the irony of trying to commit suicide with something that's homeopathic because it's almost certainly not going to have any effect.
Randy's done something similar to this on stage, hasn't he? Where he takes a bottle of homeopathic pills and just
overdoses it.
Right.
Yep.
Let's go on to some of your questions and emails. First question comes from James Boggs, who writes, "Hi, Rogues, me here. In episode 107, Jay asked, paraphrase, have you ever thought, what if you could eat whatever you wanted in any quantity, consequence-free? I, of course, have thought about that. It occurred to me that one could do this in the Star Trek holodeck. Walk in, gorge yourself on ice cream, and walk out empty. After a little more thought, I began to wonder, what would happen if you lived inside the holodeck for an extended time? When you walked out of there after living off artificial stuff, would large sections of your body be composed entirely of holodeck stuff and disappear? Maybe that's a dumb question. Have fun. Continue the excellent work, James."
First of all, any question related to Star Trek is not dumb.
Right. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Of course.
Second
totally
of all,
legitimate.
The food that is dispensed on the holodeck is much the same food that's dispensed in the...
replicator.
The quarters.
Yes, exactly. The holodeck is a combination of holographic technology and actual replication technology.
And teleporter technology.
Yes, it's like combines all the things the ship
and
can
force,
do
and
in
force
one
fields.
Room.
The real player, though, here in the holodeck, I believe, is the force fields that actually give resistance and actual shape and feel to the holographic images. Without the force fields themselves, I believe that you would really – your arms would just pass through everything and the level of realism would definitely go down a bit. But yeah, the clear answer is that yes, any food – they make it clear that any food on the holodeck is replicated food. It's real food. They have some like generic organic sort of food stuff or paste that the transporter will take, reconfigure into the form that you want, and then you eat it. And apparently it tastes pretty damn close to what it should be. So that's real food. You're going to digest it normally and no problem. But that, of course, begs the question, what would happen if you did eat holodeck food, if they did create, you know, holodeck food made out of force fields and holograms, what would happen?
And I don't think that you could even eat that, Bob.
Well, why not? I'll tell you, according to the Encyclopedia of Speculative Fiction, and they seem to really have done their homework, I think that this is what would happen.
Bob, yeah. Do me a favor. Just calm down a little
bit. Okay. it's fascinating. I know it's total make-believe, but... And I learned a lot researching this because I forgot a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I know. We've been waiting 5 weeks to talk about this.
Yeah, I know. Every year, every week it gets bumped.
You can tell.
Well, we had to wait till Rebecca wasn't on the show.
Yeah, right?
That's true.
So apparently the holodeck matter can replicate matter and, I guess, food at the molecular level. So apparently you could eat it and it would make you feel full. And I think it would be a great diet food because – You would feel full. But the problem is that they have to make sure that the hollow matter cannot replicate life. You know, it cannot, and as they put it, you can't duplicate the complexity of electron shell activity and atomic motions that determine biochemical activity in living creatures. Now, that limitation, that actually makes sense if you think about it, because if you gave that technology the ability to do that, you would actually be able to replicate life and even raise the dead, and that
but
is too powerful.
But they're doing that, Bob. I mean, when they teleport you, they're replicating
life. That's another question. I'm just talking about the holodeck. But so they have that self-imposed limitation. So if you can't replicate life, then the hollow food that you eat will never be able to integrate itself into your body. So I think what would happen is that you would just go into your digestive tract, you would feel full, and then you would, like if you ate wood, you would just excrete whatever matter was there,
you would slowly
controlled
starve,
by those
basically.
Force fields.
Norwich,
yes.
In a holodeck full of food, you'd starve to death.
Beautiful, Steve.
And imagine if you gorge in the holodeck and then you
like, oh, I'm hungry
exit.
Again.
Imagine if you created a program.
What if you ate Chinese food in the holodeck?
Yeah. I know. You'd get hungry right before you step out the door.
I always have this question.
Yes,
why
Jay?
Don't you hear the teleporter noise in the holodeck?
Because of the array buffers, buffers.
They use masking noise, yeah. You know, come to think of it, this is a stupid question.
Thanks, James.
It was fun to talk about that.
No, it's fun. It was a lot of fun. Well, even though Rebecca couldn't be with us this week, she has been busy gathering some interviews for us, as she mentioned last week, and here is the first of those interviews.
I'm standing here with John Kampfner, Chief Executive of Index on Censorship. Tell me about why we're here today.
We're here today to highlight the extent to which England's libel laws have become actually a national humiliation. It is a matter for politicians that I know of deep embarrassment that the United States, through both houses of Congress and through state legislatures, are seeking to protect its citizens from the nature of English libel laws, from the chilling effect, from the fact, whether it be Rachel Ehrenfeld originally or others since, that Americans are not able to speak freely anywhere in the world because litigious sheikhs or Russian oligarchs or others with wealth and power can simply use the pliant English courts to sue.
And you've been working on censorship law for quite a while now. When did you first cross paths with Sense About Science?
We came together with Sense not so many months ago, maybe 4 or 5 months ago. We had, prior to that, been working in parallel. And my view, and I'm relatively new to the NGO world, I've been a long-established journalist and magazine editor for many years, was that people acting collectively, no matter how sometimes difficult it may be, always have far more clout. And what we at Index, as the UK's largest free expression organisation and one of the world's most prominent, what we can bring together with PEN, which concentrates on authors and literature, and Sense About Science, which, as its name shows, concentrates on science. If you bring these together, you are covering many, if not all, the main areas where libel is causing so much damage.
And so tomorrow you take the petition to Parliament. What happens then?
Tomorrow is just another stage in the many stages of this libel campaign. As I was saying to the audience today, we've come a long way in just a month or two. We have British parliamentarians really on the run. We have Jack Straw, the Justice Secretary, promising, and we'll see if he keeps to his promise, to look at libel reform. We have the Conservatives considering it. We have the Liberal Democrats signed up. So you could say, on the one hand, aren't we doing well? My argument is we're just at the foothills. It's a classic political procedure to set up working groups, commissions, and do very little. We have a general election coming up, presumably in May, and we have to get serious and very specific libel reform into the manifestos of all three main parties.
And what can the listeners do to help the cause?
This cause, I keep on saying, is not a cause on behalf of the media, which I have long represented. It's not on behalf of lawyers or necessarily eminent scientists, important though all these groups of people are. This is about ordinary people, because the less information that is out there, the less investigative work is done, the less awkward questions are asked of people in power, the worse served the public will be. And we are already seeing that, the extent to which the chilling effect is not just taking people to the courts in libel cases. More perniciously and more dangerously and harder to quantify is the extent to which people self-censor, and so you cannot get the information out there in the first place.
Right. Can people go online to sign the petition?
People can go online. There is a generic website for all three organizations, which is libelreform.org. That's one word, libelreform.org. They should go online, engage with us, sign the petition, read the 10 points in the Index on Censorship and English Pen report, and use this as just the starting blocks. The coalition is the next stage. We want to get other organizations involved. We want to get politicians and judges who are intrinsically satisfied with the status quo, and why shouldn't they be? We want to get them rattled, and we want to get them sick and tired of us.
And just really briefly, for the Americans in the audience, I noticed a few people saying that the laws that are being passed, and you just said this, actually, the laws that are being passed in the States are actually doing a grave disservice to England. They're making England kind of the laughing stock in a way. Would you encourage the Americans in the audience to petition their congresspeople to keep those laws coming and to keep getting those things passed? Would that help the cause over here?
Most definitely. We have been buoyed by and very encouraged by the extent of the interest in the US so far in our libel campaign. It is self-evidently in the interests of all Americans to be supporting what we are doing, and we are most definitely supporting what they are doing. The more legislatures statewide who initiate legislation, and the quicker the Senate can pass the final pieces of legislation, Rachel's Law, as it's known, that will protect Americans, the more the embarrassment will be caused to the UK government. I mean, we're not talking about two somewhat distant and unfriendly states. We are talking about the two, or at least the way the Brits project this, the two closest allies in war and peace. If the Americans are so frightened and alarmed by our laws, they're protecting their citizens against us, well, you need no greater evidence of how bad things have become.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
So I'm standing here with Robin Ince, awesome comedian and defender of science. Robin, what got you involved in this campaign?
I got involved in the campaign because I've known Simon Singh for not that long, actually. I rang him up a couple of years ago, and I persuaded him to start doing comedic science about the Big Bang and Doppler effects, etc. And then it's just been a really, for me, an incredible learning curve. I'd always known that libel could stymie a certain amount of free speech, but when I first saw the after Justice Eady decided what Simon meant in his article, I was astonished. I think everyone was astonished that one man, in the space of just, he sits down, there's lawyers there ready to state their case, and he goes, well, I've decided already, and this is what it means. And I remember that night, everyone that I knew was just reeling at the fact, going, how has this decision come about that this is definitely what Simon meant? And then since that, obviously, I've got further and further involved and met up with people from Penn and Index. And libel tourism is a quite phenomenal thing, that if you can prove that maybe two copies of a Ukrainian magazine written in Swedish was for sale in a French news agent that's actually in London, if you see what I mean, so then you can probably sue in the UK about if your reputation you feel is damaged by that. It's an incredible rigmarole. I've probably made that far too much of a rigmarole, but basically all you need to do is find out that a couple of copies of a publication or something from the internet were possibly read in England, and you have a case. And there's a great case of Nick Cohen might mention to you as well, the fantastic case where Roman Polanski sued for libel. I believe it was something to do with accusations of the fact that he had committed rape, and it was tried in the UK, in England, even though it was actually a US publication, and Roman Polanski couldn't even come to England to testify because he would be arrested for the crime of statutory rape, and he won. So yeah, it's a marvellous, is it Python-esque, is it Kafkaesque? Which one of the esques is it? I'm not entirely sure.
Well, I'm amazed that as a comedian who regularly attacks religion and other sensitive subjects, that this hasn't come up for you at all. Have you ever felt any, has anyone ever come after you for what you've said?
You get a lot of stuff on the internet, but I've only once had, I mean, the trouble is that on the live stage, you can get away with a lot, unless someone's remembered to record it all. But on television, there have been... I once did a piece about mask sanity, who are the people who say that mobile phone masks are causing cancer. And I was possibly overly facetious. Actually, I don't think I was overly facetious. I think I was as facetious as I should have been. And that did end up going to the BBC Tribunal. And annoyingly, I wasn't allowed to defend myself. I didn't even know about the case, because I think I could have stood up and made it very, very clear. So, yes, the trouble is now, radio and television are so scared, and there are so many lawyers over, that the likelihood of me ever saying anything out of place, unless it's a live show, are very limited.
So you should get ready once this goes online.
Yeah. I've totally forgotten to even slander anyone in this piece, which is a great pity. Shall I start with Melanie Phillips from the Daily Mail and her ludicrous ideas about global warming? Maybe that's the point. A woman who believes in intelligent design and is considered to be an intellectual. I see that as the first falling post. If you don't believe in the theory of evolution, you are not allowed to be an intellectual. You're allowed to be interested. You're allowed to have read some books. But you are not an intellectual.
I couldn't agree more. Tell our listeners how they can find out more about what you're doing.
Generally, just go to Twitter and find me, and then I'll tell you all the boring things I'm doing and how I'm annoyed on a train because, as happened 2 nights ago, a man was sick and then picked up the sick with his fingertips for the next 10 minutes. So, yeah, if you want the latest news of me watching people vomit, then Twitter's the best place to do that.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Robin. I'm standing here with the fantastic comedian Dara O'Brien. Dara, can you tell me why you're here today?
I am No Simon, and I find myself, at the time that he was writing his book about this, I was doing my really much more caustic and childishly researched rants about McKeith or about homeopathy or about all that nonsense. To have him face a libel case when he actually has done the research and looked the stuff up doesn't augur well for those of us who fly a bit more fast and loose and hold him and people like Ben Goldacre up as our shield, essentially, so they've actually read the stuff. So it was that it was an effort that, well, you know, you can parlay a small amount of being well known into getting this case to a slightly broader audience, and people realise the seriousness of the issues involved.
And I think it's amazing the overlap between the comedians, the comic world, the science world. And here you've got a case where those two are perfectly together. I mean, this would really benefit someone like yourself as well. You tend to say a lot of, let's say, controversial things.
Well, whether or not I'm controversial, I certainly am critical of things, and I certainly would like to think that I can continue to be critical of and to vent people's general sense of disgust about certain things without feeling that a large corporation will hide behind the libel laws and try to, you know, just bully me into silence, which is essentially what this comes down to, which is it is the libel laws in this country bully people. And in fact, in this country, you know, if you're a Ukrainian journalist whose website got clicked on twice in the UK, then you can get sued by a Ukrainian oligarch. So it is nonsense, the situation. I mean, it's 140 times more expensive to have a libel case here than it is anywhere else in Europe, practically, or the average anyway. And that in itself is stopping justice being done. And nobody is saying that you shouldn't be able to have libel. Of course, if somebody writes an appalling and defamatory thing about it, you should be able to action it. But you can't even take that case if you're a small person being defamed by a big person, because you don't have that 100, 200 grand.
I have to say that in the past few months, you have become this huge star, especially amongst, I know my audience adores you. When are you coming to the States?
I don't know if I'll get over. I have a little child, and I have currently juggling time between England and Ireland, which I'd spend a lot of time in. I'll just try to create more of that routine about putting people into a sack and hitting them with sticks, which I believe has been on every skeptic website in the world. I was tracking it slowly with Google alert or something. It would tell me it popped up on James Randi's site, and then it was on Dawkins' site, and you kind of go, okay. People say, oh, Dara O'Brien sacked to me, which is fine. But like, the sack is growing. There are more people being put into the sack as time goes by. Cairo's gone back in the sack, although if you hit Cairo in the right place with a stick, actually it subluxates and it'll move your energy in a really useful way. I'm in the middle of writing a new show at the moment, and I don't know who to pick on next.
I'm sure you can find someone.
I think wellness is probably what's going to appear.
Can I put in a vote for Jenny McCarthy and the whole anti-vax?
Oh my god, anti-vax is horrendous. Like, what a great stat about there's less mercury in a vaccination shot than there is in a portion of salmon. That is a fantastic statistic. But the anti-vaxxers, you know, and they have that as well, why take the chance? You know, maybe MMR, actually. That might be one as well. Because that is a bad one.
They're causing real harm.
Oh, listen, stop. Measles kills kids. To get t-shirts printed with that and give it to people who go, well, you know, herd, I'm not a cow. For the purpose of this, you and your child are cows. There's genuine, you don't want to be dancing to the serious stuff without, you know, giving it some due care and attention. You don't want to be looking as if you're having you're getting a cheap gag out of it. But man, that is probably, anti-vax is a major one. Because since when do I turn to Jim Carrey for health advice?
Which came first, your love of science and rationality or the comedy?
They kind of both emerged at the same time. I went to university to study theoretical physics and then took up debating, which is a big deal in America, in Irish universities, where you have these big public meetings of politicians who come along and broadcasters, and the students would all speak with them and at them. I sit and love to do that, and I found I could tell jokes. But all at the same time, I was doing my theoretical physics. The circus one. In the heat of the hunt, but it's tough to shake off your inner nerd, and particularly as you get older and you can let rip with that, and when it becomes less necessary to disguise the fact that, frankly, your love of an equation is more than your love of new bands, then the nerd comes out. So yeah, they're always both there.
Thank you so much, Dara.
A pleasure.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics and Mike to figure out which one is the fake. Is everyone ready?
Mm-hmm. Ready.
Item number one. Researchers have developed a process for making boron nitride nanotubes, which they claim have superior qualities to carbon nanotubes and can be woven into macroscopic threads. Item number two. A new study finds that matching learning techniques, primarily audio versus video, to student-preferred styles results in improved academic performance. Item number three, new evidence suggests that mammoths were around as recently as 7,500 years ago, 5,600 years later than previous estimates. Mike, since you're our guest this week, go first.
Shut up. All right. For nanotubes.
Nanotubes.
Okay, nanotubes. You can make nanotubes into anything, so I'll believe that one. New study finds matching learning techniques versus video. Yes. Now, when you say mammoths, is that woolly mammoths?
Oh, yes, woolly mammoths.
Sorry, I'm being Jay here. I have no idea. I'm going to go with number two is fiction. It's the study that finds matching learning techniques, primarily audio versus video, to student-preferred styles results in an improved academic performance.
You think that one's the fiction?
I think that one's the fiction because you haven't used item number one in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I think number three is correct, just because I like mammoths.
Right.
And so number two.
So somebody actually made that comment to me on email.
Yes.
And the fact is I use a randomizer, a very sophisticated randomizer, to decide which one is the fiction each week.
It's a six-sided die,
It's
right?
a six-sided die.
And it's not the Cray computer?
Whatever it comes up with, that's what I use.
And I've been doing the science or fiction stats for the last year and the last few days, and I've noticed that you haven't used item number one much.
There's been a string of twos and threes, I admit that.
But randomness is clumpy.
Randomness is clumpy. It's purely random.
See, my strategy was going to go with whatever Bob says.
Yeah, right.
Because Bob's been doing great this year.
Well, Bob, you go next.
Oh, Mike, screw you for saying that. You picked me. These are nasty. I didn't see any of these.
oh, I can't see.
All right, the boron nitride nanotubes. Superior qualities to carbon nanotubes, and they could be woven into macroscopic threads. Well, that's a trifecta of nanotubes right there. What the hell? I might just pick that because that is such a – to me, that seems like such a big thing because – the hallmark, the nanotubes are one of the reasons they're so awesome is that they could become so many different things. You could do so many different things with them. And if this stuff can do it and also be woven into macroscopic threads, which also has been a problem with nanotubes, then that's awesome. But I didn't see that. And I looked around a little, not a lot today for news items. I didn't see that one. Makes me think that might be it. But let's look at the learning techniques. Now, so Stephen, you're saying that when teaching people that if their style prefers audio – and you detected that that's their preferred style, then that would be the best way for them to learn and not video. So if you just match it to what they prefer.
That's correct.
It'll take him all day to figure this one out.
Crap. Where the hell did you find that snippet? That was great. And the third one's confusing the hell out of me as well, too, because I remember reading years ago that they found some isolated spot where pygmy woolly mammoths survived up until like 5,000 years ago. It was like crazy close. So I don't know what to make of this one, because that totally – I got to assume that they're talking about normal-sized mammoths.
Yeah, I would assume that.
I'm going to say that the audio video, I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Yes.
Okay. Jay?
Researchers have developed a process for making boron nitride nanotubes, which they claim have superior qualities to carbon nanotubes and can be woven into macroscopic threads. I think that's science. A new study finds that matching learning techniques, primarily audio versus video, to student preferred styles results in improved academic performance. So basically you're saying that if I happen to like audio over video, that I would learn better by using audio to help me learn.
Yes.
Okay. That makes sense. The last one, new evidence suggests that mammoths were around as recently as 7,500 years ago to 5,600 years later than previous estimates. I thought that mammoths were around a lot longer ago than that. Christ. I'm going to say the mammoth one is the fake.
Okay, Evan?
Yes.
Wow. All right, well, I was going to say the mammoth one was the fake, but based on Mike's yes, I'm going to go with audio versus video. That one's fiction.
Okay. Wow, so you all agree that researchers have developed a process for making boron nitride nanotubes.
I know, that's big.
Which they claim have superior qualities to carbon nanotubes and can be woven into macroscopic threads. You all bought that.
Yep.
That one is science.
Yay!
Yes!
Bob. That's awesome. Tell me all about it, dude.
I figured, Bob, that you would take the I would have heard about that approach.
Yes, I almost did.
I was reading this. I'm like, really? Really? This is huge.
But then you're like, Mike chose number two, so I'm going to choose number two.
BNNTs. Boron nitride nanotubes have been around for a while, actually. And it's just like carbon nanotubes. They form them in the same exact kind of structure, and the same kind of crystalline structure in a tube. And it has the same strength, but it actually can survive in hotter temperatures. So that's the superior quality. So just as strong, but actually more resilient. And the breakthrough, now the problem was that when manufacturing these nanotubes, and this is probably why carbon nanotubes have been getting all the press recently, is that there were lots of flaws in the crystalline structure, which basically made them weak and useless. But they recently published a paper where they figured out a manufacturing method that not only gives you uniform crystals in large quantities, but long enough that they could be woven into string, into fibers like yarn.
Cool.
They show a picture of a quarter being suspended by a little piece of BNNT yarn. Very cool.
Nice.
Wow.
Steve, but similar electrical and optical properties and all that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Next step, space elevator.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Ooh-hoo-hoo.
So we'll see. We always have to see if this thing pans out. But this seems to be like the breakthrough we've been waiting for with nanotubes, although this is boron nitride and not carbon.
Yeah, with our luck, once they're longer than a millimeter, they explode.
Right.
With disastrous results.
Total existence failure.
The fibers show all the important properties, strength, piezoelectric activity, conductivity, and stability at high temperatures. There you go. Let's go on to number two.
Total failure.
A new study finds that matching learning techniques, primarily audio versus video, to student-preferred styles results in improved academic performance. Jay thought you thought this one was science. Everyone else thought this one was fiction.
Yeah.
And this one is the fiction.
Yes. It's the video, right, Steve? Video is uniformly best for learning, isn't it?
Not necessarily. What they found, though, this was actually not a study but a review. So some psychologists reviewed all the literature on learning styles, and they found that there was no compelling evidence for the superiority of different learning styles, and specifically matching learning styles to different students really hasn't been substantiated. It really hasn't been disproved either. They basically said that the kinds of studies that would need to be done to really test this in a controlled way haven't been done. They identified no less than 71 different models of learning in the literature. So
really?
There's been a lot of different Everyone has their own little version of it, I guess. But never tested in a controlled way. They said that the kind of study you would need to do is you would first need to come up with some way of determining what kind of student the students were, right? You'd have to sort them into, classify them as different kinds of learners, and then subject them, randomize them to the different learning techniques,
right,
and then
right.
give them a standardized test at the end to see who did better. Yeah. And that just hasn't been done to test these different models. Which means that new evidence suggests that mammoths were around as recently as 7,500 years ago, 5,600 years later than previous estimates, is science.
Cool.
Very interesting. You know what kind of evidence we're talking about?
Eyewitness.
Right.
Anecdotal.
DNA.
Oh,
not,
wow.
Not fossil evidence. What they did was they looked at frozen soils that they could date to different times, and they actually found mammoth DNA in samples that
just
are
hanging out.
As young as 7,500 years old. They gave a range, actually, I said as recently as, because it's actually a range from 7,500 right. to 10,500. So, and therefore, 5,600 to 2,600 years later than previous evidence from fossils. So that's interesting. You know, I'm not sure how solid this evidence is, but it is reasonably sure it's mammoth DNA. I guess, you know, it always depends on how reliable the dating methods are. And you wonder why no fossils, right, if they're finding the DNA.
Yeah, what's the DNA just hanging out in the frozen tundra? What the hell?
Yeah, it's just frozen into soil samples.
There you go.
They also found evidence of horses, also later than previously thought in this part of the world. This was in central Alaska.
Well, Steve, are we just talking, what, clumps of cells that are in the dirt, essentially, right?
I think it's just DNA. I don't think they're picking up scraps of animals.
I mean, you're just saying DNA, but I'm thinking, is it cellular, or is there a little tiny, tiny bit of skin or hair? And doesn't this open up a huge potential for for discovering information about other extinct animals?
They say they take a pinch of soil, so there's no tissue or anything there.
For just other – my God, how huge is that? You start taking tons of dirt and examining it. Who knows what you're going to find?
No, right. This is a new technique. They say that these findings breathe new life into the debate about why prehistoric animals such as the saber-toothed tigers, giant sloths, woolly rhinos, and mammoths apparently suddenly disappeared from the face of the earth. So this is going to add new information. Again, if the scientific community eventually concludes that this technique is legitimate and the dating is accurate, and essentially if it pans out, then they can turn this technique on all kinds of questions about which animals were alive when and where, you know.
Right. I would think there'd be limitations, though, to where, you know, the colder the area, more well-preserved, and at a certain temperature range, there'd be nothing left.
And this was in the frozen tundra, right, is where they're doing this. So they're doing it in places where you would expect that the DNA would be preserved.
Does the article actually mention mammoths, sloths, and saber-tooths?
I was reading, yeah.
Like an ice age? No.
nice try.
Saber-toothed squirrels, yeah. So good job, everyone.
Hey.
But Jay.
so as usual.
Can you play Who's That Noisy from last week?
I would love to play Who's That Noisy from last week. So I think I will.
And who was that noisy, Evan?
Well, that noisy was, in fact, the sound of a pulsar.
Mm-hmm.
Although, as I'm told, it's not a sound in the true sense, but a conversion of the radio waves received into the audio spectrum.
And was it a specific pulsar?
It was.
And which one was it?
The Vela pulsar, V-E-L-A.
And I understand that one of our listeners actually figured that out by the frequency.
What?
Really?
Specifically?
Yeah, he said pulsar Vela based on the frequency.
Nice.
Well, what was the frequency?
Because every pulsar has a signature frequency.
Right. So what was the frequency of this one? How many revolutions a second?
89.3 milliseconds. So a pulse every 89.3 milliseconds.
There you go. Well,
the human ear can't discern that.
Yeah, but you can analyze the spectrum on the computer.
This clip was sent in by a listener, Jim, from Tasmania. Tasmania, Australia, in fact. Jim is studying for his master's in astrophysics, and his subject is pulsars, and sure enough, he has access to these sorts of things.
Right. Awesome. Quite great readily. Job. So,
Jim, thank you for sending that in. And the first person to guess it correctly was from the message board, Cat's Staff, who says, my first thought is that it sounds like a pulsar. Well, you can stop with your first thought, because that is correct.
That's correct.
Well done.
But who was so specific? Who did the...
Yeah, it was actually an email from Nicole G, who pegged it as the Vela pulsar based upon its frequency. Well done.
Isn't that amazing?
What do you got for this week, Evan?
All right. Well, this week I have something special. Let's hear it.
Well, thanks, Evan. Jay, you have a quote for us this week?
Certainly. This is a quote from Galileo.
How's he doing?
He's dead.
Oh, not too well.
Long experience has taught me this about the status of mankind with regard to matters requiring thought. The less people know and understand about them, the more positively they attempt to argue concerning them. While on the other hand, to know and to understand a multitude of things renders men cautious in passing judgment upon anything new. Galileo!
He's quite a witty chap, that Galileo.
Wittiful.
So before we end the show, we just wanted to thank all of our listeners who voted for us on the podcast awards, and we actually did win in the education category, so thanks everybody. And our friend Mark Crislip won for Quackcast in the health category. So we got two skeptical podcasts in to win an award this year.
That's great.
Not bad. We'll shoot for more next year.
Fantastic.
And Mike, you got some announcements for us?
Yeah, we have the year-end wrap-up episode coming up. Just wanted to remind everyone there's a forum post on the forums. At sguforums.com under the messages and questions from the panel. And under that, the topic is year-end wrap-up and contest 2010.
There's a contest?
Oh, there's a contest. So basically, just fill out the questions, I guess, sort of like, you know, what's your favorite episode? Who do you vote for your Jackass of the Year, Skeptic of the Year? Things like that. And yeah, there's a contest. So every person who replies to the topic before December 22nd on the forums will be put into a random draw for a prize. And the prize is the first issue of the New England Journal of Skepticism, which is what the New England Skeptical Society, the NES, sent to its members back in, I guess that first one went out in 96.
Yep, back before blogs and podcasts.
January 1996.
Printed on paper.
That issue will be signed, autographed by the entire SGU cast, right, guys?
Absolutely.
And a bonus prize is the winner will be able to pick a Skeptics Guide t-shirt that we will also send to them. From our available designs, and these are the designs from the live event shirts, not our Cafe Press store, but if you don't win, go to our Cafe Press store and get a shirt of your own.
Well, thanks, Mike.
Problem. Thank you, Mike. I have a few other things. Just wanted to remind everyone, because we don't mention it enough, that we do have another podcast, the SGU 5x5. Go check it out. It's pretty awesome. You can find us on theskepticsguide.org and at sguforums.com. We are on Twitter at twitter.com/skepticsguide and on Facebook. And if you like the podcast, go give us a good review on iTunes.
Or Zune, or whatever your aggregator is.
Yes.
Yes, we like Zune, too. Yep. We're actually number one on Zune right now under science.
Yeah.
We are?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so thanks to all of our Zune listeners.
Yep.
Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Good to be joined to you.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.